This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. In state after state, special elections to fill seats have seen political upset after political upset. It is Democrats who keep upending Republican candidates. And last weekend, that happened in Texas. Could Texas be shaping up for a rare contested election? Drew Landry is a professor of political science at South Plains College in Lubbock, and he joins us now to talk that and other political things. Thanks for joining us again on the West Texas Dispatch, Drew.
Good to be here, George. Thanks for having me on.
Drew, that Democrat, Taylor Remmett, he defeated the Republican in a Texas Senate special election on Saturday. The Republican had Trump's endorsement. He raised three times more money than, or she did, three times more money than the Democrat. And it was a solidly Republican seat outside of Fort Worth. Remmett, the Democrat, won by 17 points. Shocking? And is it a bellwether for what might happen next year?
Yeah, Greg. Great question here, George. When we look at these special elections, I'm often reminded that special things can happen during these times. Lots of things to really consider here. The voter turnout are typically low when compared to, like, you know, a normal cycle, like a midterm or a presidential election. So the turnout was low. Even in that special election that was held in November, and then you had this runoff just, you know, last week, and even the turnout then was considerably lower than what you had in the November special election. So you had a lower turnout. You also had a very energized Democratic base with the recent happenings that's taken place up in Minneapolis and Minnesota. The Democrats were very much energized, and Remmett was able to really articulate a message about public schools, about the whole blue collar worker conversation, and that really resonated. I mean, this is going to sound really like silly and simple, but he just outworked her. That's really what it came down to. I mean, he was putting boots on the ground, doing a lot of what's called the ground game. He was tremendously outspent, as you mentioned. But even with that, he was able to only lose just about maybe a half or 2% of his votes from the November special election. So, you know, it was just the right time, right place, right message. Now, you asked about, is this a bellwether for November? I'm not ready to really say that, because the midterm election, we don't know what's going to happen in the next 10 months. You know, maybe the economy will turn around, and the tariffs, and maybe the president is right about all those things that he's been saying. Maybe all those things really do take shape, and that's going to, you know, buoy the Republicans here. Or things can stay the way that they are, and you get more of this momentum for the Democrats. It's just, you know, if we talk about this in September, you know, that's going to have a much clearer picture as to what's going to happen. But I will say this, when we look at the last couple of midterm elections for this seat, they've been about 277,000. So we're close to 300,000 voter turnout. That may have an effect on the end result there, because turnout matters. And the Democrat here was able to energize, tap into that very energized Democratic a voter base in this runoff, and it paid off well for him.
I like how you say wait until September, because as we know from watching past elections, it's so much of it has to do with how do you feel at that moment, and what is my pocketbook saying, and what is my wife saying about the cost of groceries. Those things matter.
Absolutely, they really do matter, and the message that you make from that also matters as well. You know, if you're talking about groceries and affordability, and you can't talk about how much things cost, then you're looked as being out of touch on this. And so, the messaging at the time and the timing of everything, you know, is the economy back? Did the tariffs work? You know, how is the farm bill? Is there a farm bill? You take all those things and you message that and you bring that into your campaign message when you're even talking about a state senate race. Those things matter.
Well, that's Fort Worth. Let's kind of narrow it down a little bit and get us to West Texas. We're planning a couple of shows, by the way, centered around the U.S. House District 19 race, the District 71 Texas House race. Those are soon to be vacated seats. There are tons of people running for both of those. But what other West Texas races out there do we need to be keeping an eye on right now?
You know, it's interesting when we look at that, you know, we have the state Senate race for state Senate District 28. You know, you have the incumbent Charles Perry, who's, you know, been there for, well, he's been in the legislature since 2011, but he's been in the state Senate since 2014, 2015. So he actually has a general election opponent, a guy out of Abilene, actually, Riley Rodriguez, who's challenging him for the general election. There hasn't been a Democrat who's ran for this seat since that 2014 special election. That was Greg right. Wortham at the time. And that race had a lot of people in it. And so we all thought it was going to be a runoff. Charles Perry really stunned a lot of people by getting that majority vote. So there was no need for a runoff then. Senator Perry has been very good at being able to fundraise. He's got a very large war chest. Riley Rodriguez is a new person coming onto the scene. So fundraising is going to be a bit of a challenge for him. Excuse me. So with that in mind, that's going to mean access to voters, you know, your ability to run ads, your ability to make, you know, direct mailers, you know, yard signs, all those things to get your name out there. And Senator Perry's been doing that for a long time. He's very seasoned at this, and his district is, you know, really leans towards him. But so that's really the other type of race that's really, really going on here. He hasn't really had a really much of a problem in securing his election. So, and that's a 4-year term. And so mm-hmm. this, you know, he's got an agenda. I mean, he has a record to run on. People kind of like that record. So, unseating him is a challenge. And that's what the Democrat really has to convince people to fire him to put it that way, and to hire him.
And at least the Republicans don't see weakness there, because he doesn't have a primary opponent.
That's right.
Speaking of the primaries, we've got some dates coming up. We've got some big things coming up. People are going to want to vote in those primaries. And again, we're going to talk about the District 19 congressional race and the state House race that is so complicated with so many people running because it was vacated. But what kind of dates need to be in people's minds to make sure their votes count?
Okay, so we have early voting. I mean, we're one of the first states that brought that in all the way back to the late 1980s. So we early vote here in Texas 17 days, usually 2 weeks before Election Day. Folks, we start early voting February 17th, goes all the way up till the fourth day before Election Day. So I believe that's February 27th. Election Day is March 3rd. And so Tuesday, March 3rd, if you don't early vote in that time, you got one more day. And so those are some big, big dates to really keep in mind. You know, I'm always an advocate for getting people to vote. Let your voice be heard.
Amen. Mr. Landry, thank you for joining us today.
George, it's always good to be here. Thank you, sir.
Well, we appreciate having Drew Landry again on the West Texas Dispatch. He's a professor of government and political science at South Plains College. He joined us from his offices in Lubbock. Opioid use is a nationwide issue, and West Texas is no exception. StarCare and Lubbock Public Health partnered last week to provide information on recognizing and responding to an opioid overdose, as well as addressing some common myths and risk factors. KTTZ's Samantha Larnett attended the training and has more.
Avery Alexander is the opioid use disorder outreach specialist for StarCare. She says opioid use is a rising issue here in Lubbock.
We're kind of fighting two monsters at the same time. We're fighting people who are kind of in denial about it, saying that we do have a problem, but at the same time we have these people on the other side who are actually using these substances.
Some classic signs of an opioid overdose include cold or clammy skin, dizziness or disorientation, unresponsiveness, slow breathing, choking or snoring sounds, small pupils, and discoloration of the lips and nails. Naloxone is a medication that can reverse an opioid overdose. If you ever have to administer naloxone, Alexander stresses the importance of calling 911 as well.
It's not treatment. It's just something to hold someone over until they can get medical treatment. So don't think, well, I gave them some naloxone, they're fine. No, because after that 30 to 90 minutes wears off, they can overdose again.
According to Alexander, naloxone is safe for anyone, including children and those who are pregnant. Naloxone has a long shelf life, can endure extreme temperatures, like if you leave it in a car, and is available at pharmacies without a prescription. Alexander encourages people to educate themselves and carry naloxone just in case, even if they don't think they'll be in a situation to use it.
It's better to have the education and have the tools to respond to opioid than find yourself in a situation where you need it and you don't have it. So do what you want to do, but this is something that's happening, and it's better to be prepared before it comes knocking on your door.
I'm Samantha Larned.
Schools used to be considered sensitive locations avoided by immigration agents. President Trump rescinded that longstanding policy when he began his second term. Decades ago, Border Patrol actions at a Texas school resulted in a federal lawsuit. KTEP's Aaron Montez has the story of the El Paso students who won that landmark case.
On a recent morning, students and their teacher at Bowie High School talk about the lesson that day. About 1,000 students attend the school. Many live nearby and walk to campus. The high school sits on 60 acres of land in south-central El Paso, less than a mile from the U.S.-Mexico border. Back when Ernesto Munoz was a sophomore at Bowie in September 1992, he said it was common for Border Patrol agents to drive up to students.
Agents would step out of the vehicle and just, you know, round us up and have us, you know, stand up, you know, against the vehicles and we would have our backpacks emptied out.
Munoz recalls the time when he was stopped. Agents asked him for identification. All he had was his school ID. He says that wasn't enough, and they continued to question him about his citizenship. Munoz is a U.S. citizen.
To get us to admit to having crossed the border illegally, you know, they would say things like, you match the description of somebody that we just witnessed crossing illegally, and that is why we're stopping you.
It happened so often, Munoz and other students organized meetings to share their experiences and discuss how to get help.
It was a very clear abuse of the rights of these United States citizens and of the United States Constitution.
Albert Armendariz Jr. is one of the attorneys who helped students and staff at Bowie High School sue the Border Patrol. They alleged agents violated federal policy by racially profiling citizens and legal residents of Hispanic descent. El Paso is more than 80% Mexican American.
A parade of witnesses, students, teachers, the coach, the principal's secretary, all these people that described what had been done to them.
In the spring of 1992, agents stopped four students on the way to school and took them to a detention center. All were U.S. citizens or legal residents. In November of 1991, a Border Patrol agent stopped a Bowie football coach and, during questioning, pulled a gun on him. And in October 1991, Border Patrol agents questioned the principal's secretary on the way home. She was also a U.S. citizen, Armendariz says.
They made her get out of the car. They searched her car. They searched her trunk. They interrogated her. And they had absolutely no reason to stop her. That is completely unlawful.
The Border Patrol sector chief at the time, Dale Muse-Gates, testified and defended agents' actions. And then the federal judge made his decision, Armendariz says.
It goes on and on and on, page after page after page, detailing the abuses that these students and teachers and staff members were subjected to.
On October 23, 1992, Judge Lucius Bunton issued an injunction preventing Border Patrol agents from stopping people based on race alone. And the judge ruled enforcement of immigration law does not override the rights of U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Armendariz said Border Patrol agreed agents would get annual training about constitutional rights. Munoz and other students were relieved.
Border Patrol was still very present in our lives, but we now had a safe zone there in our school.
It's been more than 30 years since the landmark case, but Munoz is once again looking over his shoulder. He anxiously watches as Border Patrol and ICE agents across the country question and detain parents and students near schools. And he's worried about being racially profiled at Home Depot and other places where people have been arrested.
As a family, we decided to apply for our passports. So even though I'm an American citizen, we submitted our applications and I carry my passport with me everywhere I go.
He believes now that's necessary to protect himself and his family.
I'm Aaron Montes in El Paso.
Crimes like domestic violence and sexual assault are still seriously underreported in West Texas, as they are nationwide. That's according to advocates with the Family Crisis Center of the Big Bend, one of the only organizations dedicated to serving survivors of such crimes across five rural counties. Marfa's Public Radio's Mary Cantrell reports that while combating these pervasive crimes on the local level is no easy feat, Crisis Center employees remain committed to facing the issue head on.
We're actually at a staff meeting right now.
Crisis Center staff wrap up phone calls as a meeting gets underway at their office and emergency shelter in Alpine. They affix orange ribbons for Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month to their shirts. The roughly 40-year-old nonprofit recently raised over $1 million to purchase and renovate its new building. Leticia Carrillo is the group's executive director. A former local law enforcement officer, she says even she didn't realize how extensive the center's services are.
We provide not just emergency shelter, we provide counseling, we provide financial assistance. We help them in finding employment. We help them with childcare.
Someone who's directly benefited from those services is Delisa Kearns, a single mom in Alpine. She separated from her husband, then experienced a debilitating stroke in 2018 that prompted her to reach out to the Crisis Center. Kearns says it's hard to put trauma and abuse into words and seek out help. But when she did, the Crisis Center jumped in to provide basic household supplies, financial assistance with bills, and emotional support for her and her two girls.
Nobody chooses to be abused. Nobody chooses to get married to get a divorce. It just happens. You just hope you live day by day.
The Crisis Center runs other critical social services like transportation, shuttling residents to doctor's appointments and airports in cities hours away, and food distribution. Here's Carrillo again.
We have to pick up and do things that maybe aren't really in our scope, but we do it because if we don't do it, who else will do it?
The Crisis Center's satellite offices in Presidio and Terlingua reflect the character of the communities they serve. The Terlingua location, in the heart of the ghost town, has stone floors, a bamboo ceiling, and even a resident roadrunner. Mike Drinkard, a 20-year client advocate, can be found here most days. Once a month, the office serves as a food distribution center for the entire area, with volunteers passing out hundreds of boxes of supplies.
The days when we have the food, there's food everywhere and all the freezers are stuffed full of stuff.
The Terlingua location is also known for its support groups and art classes. Drinkard says his work is emotionally sensitive, requiring him to be judgment-free.
But it's a trauma-informed approach that we take, just knowing what the effects of trauma are and putting ourselves in their place.
The Crisis Center serves around 1,300 people a year, primarily women. Last year, they saw around 200 new clients. Client and legal advocate Virginia Sandoval says, statistically speaking, that number should be higher, given the nonprofit's vast service area.
We don't have a huge population, but we're not immune to these type of assaults. We know that because we hear things, people aren't coming to us.
She says fear, stigma, and lack of faith in the legal system keep people away. That's why her group amplifies its reach by hosting education and awareness programs. Advocates talk to students about topics like healthy relationships and cyberbullying. Sandoval says sometimes she watches students in the crowd, looking for visible reactions from those she thinks might be in an abusive relationship themselves.
and their eyes kind of just like, for a split second, like there's that, oh, wow. But then it quickly shuts down because they don't want anybody else to know that they've made some kind of sign, that they've led on.
Sandoval hasn't had a single client press abuse or assault charges in the past year. The advocacy group Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, citing FBI data, reports for every 1,000 sexual assaults, only 25 result in any jail time. Kern says even though her decision to open up to local advocates wasn't easy, the consistent care they've shown her makes her feel like she's a part of one big family.
Especially over the years, when the last thing you want to do is cry out for help when you don't know how to. And then when you do, and then people actually come to you to help, it's amazing.
While the crisis center services are free, they don't receive a dollar from the majority of local governments they serve, except for Brewster County and the city of Alpine, which each contribute less than $10,000 a year. Carrillo, the executive director, says she'd like to see more investment from those entities moving forward, given the vital resources the center provides. I'm Mary Cantrell in Marfa.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. Texas is well known for its place in the global oil and gas market. But in recent decades, the Lone Star State has grown into a giant in clean energy, too. More than 10,000 wind turbines are scattered over West Texas, with the potential to generate energy for 9 million homes. The industry has grown 500% over the last 15 years. And the solar segment of the grid is also growing. The state added 39 new solar farms just last year, and an international group broke ground on the newest project located in Concho County last week. KACU's Heather Claiborne spoke with co-developer Derek Eugene, CEO of High Road Energy Marketing, about the impact of this project for West Texas.
The project is being developed by a group that's nicknamed Team Korea and includes Hyundai and Korea Midland Power, among others. What attracted this international group to build their largest solar project outside of Asia in Paint Rock, Texas?
We had gone in and done, you know, much of the advanced work, signing up the landowners, getting the interconnection study done, the production studies done. So we were able to present them with a package that let them know this project would be profitable. So that was one aspect. And then the main aspect is that the sun shines a lot and very well there in that part of West Texas.
Yeah, for sure. We get a lot of sunshine. We get a lot of wind. There's been a lot of opportunity for, alternative sources of energy to start developing the market out in West Texas. I'm curious about what would this look like if somebody could take maybe a bird's eye view of the project? Can you give us some context for how big it's going to be physically?
Yes, it's a 350 megawatt utility scale power plant project. And to put that on scale, your average, you know, coal-fired power plant is about 700 megawatts. So that 350 megawatts will power about 60,000 homes. And it sits on about 2,900 acres. There in Concho County. Again, we located it there because it's some of the best production capabilities in terms of the amount of time that the sun shines, how long it shines, et cetera, provides some of the best production capabilities in the state.
And other aspects of the geography or other aspects that make it a good location?
You know, it's hard to locate a solar project on the side of a mountain or in a heavily wooded area. And so the areas in and around Concho County make for perfect locations for solar projects. And then it was located very close to a large transmission line. So those were the capabilities that made this an ideal location.
Getting the power to the grid once it's generated is one of the things I've had questions about for a long time. It's my understanding there's a certain amount of degradation as you get further away from, you know, the part that you're powering or where you're sending the power to. So tell us a little bit about that aspect of it. Where is this energy going to end up?
Well, this energy will end up on the grid in ERCOT. We'll get it there through a large transmission lines that are the responsibility of LCRA. And, you know, as you outline, you're going to get as much energy to the grid as the transmission lines allow. And so in that area and with our project, we had sufficient amount of transmission to get the electricity to the grid. From there, it goes wherever the electrons go. Texas is going to need as many electrons on the network as possible over the next 10 years as the growth in energy demand, data centers, et cetera, is going to place a heavy load on our electricity grid.
Well, let's talk about that. Is this something that the solar farm could intentionally direct to a specific project like an AI data center, or is it just going to the grid and it will just help to create energy for whoever needs it?
The energy has been sold to several large users, household names that are going to use this to decarbonize their network. But that's more or less a financial arrangement. Practically, the electricity goes into the grid and is going to be used by anyone that taps into the grid. So the more electricity, the more capacity that we have on the grid, I mean, everyone benefits.
It's really for a long time been well known as an oil and gas producing state. But I think a lot of people are less familiar with the fact that it is a leader in other sources.
Absolutely.
Of alternative energy.
Yes, we've been a leader in solar and wind for maybe a decade or more. And we believe in all of the above in terms of energy production. We should have traditional forms of energy production, oil and gas, as well as solar and wind.
This project is supposed to create 500 construction jobs. But that's just the construction. Long term, it's my understanding there's going to be $5 million in local tax revenue generated, as well as a program that's going to help local farmers. Tell us a little bit about that.
Absolutely. So one of the other things that attracted the international investors was our community engagement strategy that HiRO Energy Marketing had developed. And that strategy focused on ways of improving the workforce in the local area and ways of supporting farmers and landowners that might be underrepresented in the solar energy. So we're working with the local San Angelo ISD on a workforce development program, and we're working with local farmers on what's called agrivoltaics, which is the combination of solar energy production, as well as the kinds of agriculture that you can do in connection with the solar program or project. Those would be pilot sites, away from our actual large site, but pilot sites where we could pilot maybe a 10-acre program looking at beekeeping, sheep grazing, or even wineries in connection with the development of a solar project.
Do you have a sense of how much investment this project is going to make into that aspect?
It's estimated about $300,000 a year over the next 15 years because of the commitment of our off-takers, and the developers have made a commitment to generating about that much funds that are going to the what's called the RAIN Up program, Renewable Agriculture Inclusion for Underrepresented People. We're going to have, a considerable impact on the local school district, Paint Rock ISD. We will increase, their budget. We'll become one of the largest taxpayers in Paint Rock ISD, increasing their budget by an average of about $2 million a year. So for those 300 students in Paint Rock ISD, this is going to be a significant windfall. And this is the kind of impact that solar projects are having across the state. So we believe there's a great opportunity for solar renewable energy in the state of Texas.
That's KACU's Heather Claiborne speaking with Derek Eugene, CEO of HiRO Energy Marketing. He is a co-developer of the Lucy Solar Project. The developers say they expect the solar farm to be up and running in the third or fourth quarter of 2027. It's time for West Texas Roots. We're journeying to northern Coleman County, where one family's connection to the land spans generations and continents. What began with an Englishman managing royal estates for the King of England eventually led to a vast ranch stretching across Coleman, Callahan, and Taylor counties.
My family has had the privilege of owning a ranch in North Coleman County for the last 32 and a half years. This ranch was established in the early 1800s. The 1880s, by a family from England named Cresswell. Mr. Cresswell Sr. actually worked for the King of England and had gone to college with him in school, and they were friends. And he ended up being the ranch foreman or ranch manager of the properties, all the ag properties in England. He was paid a salary, but he also got a percentage of the profits that were created off those different agricultural ventures. And so he saved up his profits of that and decided to buy land in the New World and in West Texas when land was very, very cheap. He acquired 20,000 acres of land in what is now Coleman, Callahan, and Taylor counties, and they began ranching. How he began ranching is he had an 18-year-old son, Gerard Cresswell, and that son, as an 18-year-old, was sent by his father, who had acquired this land, to come to West Texas and run the ranch. They began raising cattle in that region in the early 1800s. And everybody knew about the Cresswell Ranch, and it was a big enough entity that everybody worked on the Cresswell Ranch at one time or another, especially during harvest time. The Cresswell family had a very strong influence in that area back in those days. And I don't know how long it was after he was here, but he married a local lady that grew up in and around Oplin. They had two children, and those children were named Gerard Cresswell Jr., or Jerry, as I knew him growing up. And his sister was named Dorothea Cresswell Griffin. She raised registered Hereford cattle south of Lawn, Texas. Gerard, her brother, raised registered Black Angus cattle in Coleman County. The Cresswell family imported the first Black Angus cattle to this country from Illinois sometime in the 1916 or 1918. I actually had that in a Forward Star Telegram article I wrote, one of Mr. Cresswell Sr.'s obituary. And I find that fascinating because I thought everybody would have known. And I found it interesting that his sister stayed with raising Hereford cattle and he had Black Angus cattle. I remember as a boy, he would have special bull sales at Abilene Auction. But the family was a very revered ranch family, and everybody enjoyed working for the Cresswells. Gerard Cresswell Jr. was a contemporary of my grandfather, so he would have been born in the late 1890s. They played dominoes together on the front porch of an old service station in downtown Oplin, Texas. I spent many hours just sitting there when I was probably 5, 6, 7 years old with my granddad, lazy summer afternoons and listening to domino shuffle and old men tell stories. And Mr. Cresswell was one of those gentlemen. Sold that ranch in 1971 to a man that I knew named Leon Barr. So they had actually run that ranch from the 1880s to 1971. And Mr. Barr ran that ranch until 1992, when my family was able to, or my wife and I acquired a portion of that ranch. We only ended up buying about 2,000 acres, but it was on the Jim Ned Creek, and a very beautiful ranch it was. There was a grave site on this ranch, and Mr. Cresswell told Mr. Barr when he bought the ranch, and Mr. Barr told me when I bought the ranch, that this grave site needed to be maintained. And the story was that there was either a child born deceased or a young child died. But the Great Western Trail cattle drive was going from south to north. I can find no history on the child. Nobody knows names, ages, or anything. But anyway, the grave has been maintained. And if we sell the ranch or get the completion of the ranch, that will be one of the requests, is maintain that.
We collected Brand Jones's story at the Texas Farm Ranch and Wildlife Expo in Taylor County. West Texas Roots is made possible in part by a grant from the Dr. Paula Windham Fund for Education and Community Development, and from a gift from the Doris Miller and Don Fitzgibbons Donor Advised Fund at the Community Foundation of Abilene. This is the West Texas Dispatch. The late Joe Ely was recognized earlier this week at the Grammys. Ely, who was a leading force in progressive country radio in the 1970s and 80s, made his strongest success among eclectic crowds in Austin. But some of his earliest collaborators were found in the West Texas hub city of Lubbock. KTTZ's Brad Burt spoke with Ely's friends and fellow musicians as they reflected on Ely's origin and the role he played in their lives.
Many young people have looked around Lubbock, Texas, and realized there's little else to do but share a few drinks and play some songs in a hazy bar with friends until it's time to move on, or someone makes them. Others have responded to this view as reductive, choosing to take the best of what others will fly over or drive past as a challenge or an inspiration. Few have lived the best of both of these seemingly contradicting mindsets, quite like Joe Ely. According to his family, Ely died on December 15th at his home in Taos, New Mexico, at the age of 78. Ely was a Texas music legend who drove humbly at the leading edge of an evolutionary wave in alternative country music, and many talented musicians came with him. Eli's bandmate Butch Hancock said it must be something in the water.
It's something in the air, it's something in the dirt and the dust and the earth, and it's something in the blazing sun. It's in everything you encounter. It's there's something in there that's vitally important, whether you like it or not.
Another Lubbock native musician, artist, and friend of Ely's for more than 50 years, Terry Allen, said for many, it's probably boredom.
You know, I think boredom is the mother of invention. It was so, you know, boring in a sense of, you know, the place to live, that you had to make your own fun. You had to make your own good times and your own entertainment. And I think it came out of that.
Born in Amarillo in 1947, Ely spent his formative years in Lubbock, where he would join with Hancock and Jimmie Dale Gilmore in 1972 to form the Flatlanders. While the group's initial discography was short-lived, each artist went on to contribute in distinctive ways.
I think that's why he and Jimmy and I got together and just instantly bonded. We understood where each other were coming from, and although we did different results with it. And then when we started blending those results, we found out, wow, these things can fit together because our concepts are relatable.
Starting in the honky-tonk bars of Lubbock in the early 1970s, where once sternly divided crowds of country and rock fans were finally beginning to merge, Ely went from Lubbock to Austin, across the country, and eventually around the world. By 1975, Ely joined with future global recording artist Jesse Guitar Taylor and record producer Lloyd Maines.
That was such a great time in Lubbock, I think, because it was so fertile with places to play and great musicians, and it was kind of before the exit to Austin had happened. It's one of the few times I remember being in Lubbock where musicians could actually make a living playing music.
Terry Allen formally met Joe Ely and Jesse Taylor when Lloyd Maines was recording Allen's record, Lubbock on Everything, and a night of talking collaboration became a nonstop night at a local juke joint on the east side of Lubbock.
The guy served pork chop sandwiches and had a pool table, and we all shot pool and ate pork chop sandwiches and drank heavily until the sun came up the next day. And so that was kind of my first meeting with Joe, and it set off kind of a very long friendship.
Ely's band played often at the original Stubbs Barbecue in Lubbock. Ely eventually convinced Stubblefield to follow him and move Stubbs to Austin, contributing to the design and marketing for Stubbs' world-famous barbecue sauce. 1 year after Ely's first solo self-titled album with MCA Records was released in 1977, his travels led him on a life-altering trip to London, where he crossed paths with iconic British punk rock pioneers, The Clash. Through his travels, Ely managed to bring pieces of his success back to West Texas, but for many in Lubbock at the time, some of Ely's most memorable returns came with the Tornado Jam concerts, which Ely planned in the 1980s. Ely was inducted into Lubbock's West Texas Walk of Fame in 1989 and into the Austin City Limits Hall of Fame in 2022. Ely released more than 20 albums over the course of his career, including his last in 2025, Love and Freedom, recorded in his home studio. The album maintained what made Ely's music feel special for many over his entire career. No self-imposed boundaries for what a songwriter could be. Terry Allen said Lubbock's role as a hub city for the highways of West Texas, far from the rest of the metros, has always brought different people together. Butch Hancock agreed that they were all impacted by what it feels like to follow a straight, flat highway toward the horizon and where it leads.
You should have heard it some of the times on the tour buses. going through America on all kinds of roads, back roads and interstates, trying to figure out where all these words came from, all these songs came from, all these cities came from, all our friends, and gosh, the new people we would meet. We were so fortunate. And there's so much goodness in this world.
Hancock says he's been speaking to fellow Flatlander Jimmy Dale Gilmore, but talking about Joe Ely publicly will be hard on the heart. Hancock spoke about the power of language and song to move people from across beliefs and origins, but added there's another important magic in the silence.
Walk out of the city 5 or 10 miles, lay down in a cotton patch, and talk to the stars, and then get home as the dawn comes up. I mean, I've done that, Joe's done that, Jimmy's, we've all been out there in the boonies. You gotta clean your heart out time after time.
I'm Brad Burt in Lubbock.
I gave all my money to the banker this month. Now I got no more money to spend. She smiled when she saw me coming through that door. When I left, she said, come.
This has been the West Texas Dispatch. We're marking 1 year on the air with this episode, and we hope you've enjoyed this addition to the local news landscape. We look forward to keeping you informed on all things West Texas for another year, and we appreciate your support and kind words of encouragement. We also want to take a moment to thank our partners in West Texas at KTTZ in Lubbock, Marfa Public Radio, and KTEP in El Paso, and Harvest Public Media for their partnership in covering the issues and stories in our part of the Lone Star State. Thanks to all who shared your personal histories, and thanks to Glenn Dromgoole for sharing some of his thoughts this year. If you like what you're hearing, help spread the word. We're here each Wednesday at noon, and the West Texas Dispatch is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can even find it on the KACU mobile app. Our executive producer is Heather Claiborne. We had extra help from digital editor Calvin Claiborne. J.C. Gamble wrote our theme. I'm George Levesque.